Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from the beating heart of the 561 in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined, as always, by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy.
Hiya, George.
All right. Well, the one-year anniversary of the Parkland massacre is approaching, and even after a year, the murder of 17 students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Broward County remains a very raw and potent issue at several levels of Florida politics and across the ideological spectrum. We're going to talk in this podcast about the angry reaction that some Parkland parents and South Florida Democrats had to President Donald Trump's State of the Union address this past week. And John Kennedy is going to fill us in on how some Parkland-related issues for the second year in a row will loom during legislative session in Tallahassee. And Zach Anderson will tell us about an effort to bypass the Republican-controlled legislature and enact a ban on assault weapons in Florida. Plus, new Governor Ron DeSantis has released his first budget, and it's drawing some surprising reactions. We'll talk about that. And fired FBI Director James Comey, who describes himself these days as a semi-employed celebrity, was in Florida recently and offering his takes on President Trump's witch hunt label for the Mueller investigation. And he's also weighing in on the indictment of Florida man Roger Stone. That's all coming up in the podcast. But first, I believe I hear some kind of funky, royalty-free music playing. Listeners to the podcast know as soon as you hear that music that means it's time for our pick a number segment. That's the portion of the podcast where each of us puts forward a number, and then later on we explain what that number means in Florida politics. John Kennedy, would you like to go first today? What is your number for the pick a number segment?
Sure, George. Yeah, I have a number here. It's 793.
John Kennedy going with a 793 from Tallahassee. Zach Anderson over in Sarasota, what number do you have for us this week?
George, I'm going to throw out a 50.7.
Ooh, 50.7. Well, I'm also putting a decimal point into the mix. George Bennett here in West Palm Beach. My number is 13.6. So just to review those numbers, and as always, we encourage podcast listeners to take notes during the pick a number segment and throughout the podcast, as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery. And those numbers from lowest to highest are 13.6 for me, George Bennett, 50.7 for Zach Anderson, and the curve buster from Tallahassee, John Kennedy, with a number 793. So we will revisit those numbers later on in the podcast and find out what they mean in Florida politics. But first, let's get to our loaded lineup. February 14th is approaching, and it's a grim date in Florida history. It was on that date in 2018, Valentine's Day, that Nicholas Cruz walked onto the campus of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland with a semi-automatic weapon and murdered 17 students and staff. Aside from the predictable debate about gun control, Parkland has raised a lot of other issues. Among them, it was revealed that the Broward Sheriff's Office and the school district in Broward County had multiple interactions with the gunman and warnings about him before the rampage. And then it came to light that the sheriff's deputies, as the shooting was taking place, took cover outside the classroom building where it was going on rather than go in and confront the gunman. And one of the first things Ron DeSantis did as governor, I believe it was on his fourth day in office, was to suspend Broward Sheriff Scott Israel. And there continues to be an effort in Broward County, including by many of the Parkland parents, to force the superintendent of schools, Robert Runcie, to resign. And we saw just an illustration of how the passions that that Parkland still inspires this past week at the State of the Union address. Three different members of Congress invited parents of Parkland victims to come hear President Trump's speech. Trump did not mention Parkland or any gun violence issues or policy issues about guns in the speech. That drew criticism from Congressman Ted Deutch. He's a Democrat from Boca Raton whose district includes Parkland. And Deutch's guest for the evening was also very critical of it. Deutch's guest was Manuel Oliver, whose son Joaquin was killed at Parkland. And Mr. Oliver criticized the president for focusing on crimes by illegal immigrants rather than gun deaths. And on Twitter, he said, quote, "If you want your murdered son or daughter to be mentioned at the State of the Union, make sure the killer of your kid is an illegal immigrant. In this perfect nation, crimes with the blessing of the NRA are fine." Some very bitter words for Manuel Oliver. And then the next day, Mr. Oliver got in a shouting match with Congressman Matt Gaetz, from the Republican from the Florida Panhandle, at a congressional hearing on guns, when Gaetz was saying that illegal immigrants basically pose a bigger problem than guns. As I said, it was just all a reminder of how the passions still run high on issues related to Parkland. And with the legislative session coming up in Tallahassee, John Kennedy, fill us in a little bit on how Parkland-related issues are likely to come up this year for the second year in a row.
Yeah, well, it's coming back. I mean, this one-year anniversary of the shootings is going to be marked by moments of silence at schools around the state, and the Capitol is going to be bathed in orange light as part of the commemoration. But legislators are already ready to revisit the legislation that was pretty hastily put together last year following the tragedy. And one of the most contentious elements of that effort is the idea of arming teachers. That idea was kicked around last year for a while, and it's back this year. The Senate Education Committee has rolled out a bill aimed at expanding the pool of eligible school guardians. These are the school employees who have volunteered to be trained to be armed and provide security at a school in case of an active shooter. Full-time teachers last year were barred. They were prohibited from participating in the program under the law. But the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission, which met for the latter part of last year, they recently recommended that teachers be trained, along with a host of other recommendations for making schools be more secure and provide better access to mental health programs, among their other recommendations. But it's the idea of arming teachers that really may make the 2019 session very similar to last year's legislature. The state's biggest teachers union, the Florida Education Association, is against it. And just this week, 500 women from around the state, part of the organization Moms Demand Action, they fanned out across the Capitol lobbying legislators to reject the idea, just like last year.
John, let me ask you, just so I'm clear, the arming teachers idea would be the teachers would have the option of being armed. It wouldn't require them.
Oh, absolutely.
Armed, right.
Yeah. These would be people that would step forward and you know, seek training.
And is there any way of gauging how many teachers might be interested in doing that?
Well, hard to say. It would present a huge eligibility pool, presumably, but right now, you know, there are only, under the current program that prohibited teachers, full-time teachers, there are only 688 guardians in the state's 3,600 schools. So it's really a numbers game. You know, every school has to have a guardian school resource officer or a school safety officer, basically somebody armed at these 3,600 schools. But the commission has concluded that, you know, having just one armed officer at a school probably isn't enough. And that's stirred up this legislation, which it's going to get its first hearing next week. But you're going to hear a lot of the same unease that scuttled the idea last year. You know, having the support of the commission, though, that may give it some heft this year. And, you know, worth pointing out is that the only member of the 15-member commission to vote against arming teachers was Max Schachter, whose 14-year-old son, Alex, was among the slain students at the school.
Okay. And you know, in mentioning that, so in the upcoming session, more debate about school safety, school security kind of issues. And clearly in the Republican-controlled Florida legislature, there's no serious talk about any kind of gun control measures, correct?
Yeah, that doesn't seem like it's there is some legislation to expand background checks, but even that would be a huge lift for this Republican-led legislature.
Sure. And so with given that, it's interesting, though, and Zach Anderson is going to fill us in. There is an effort underway to enact an assault weapons ban in Florida. And obviously, you'd have to bypass the legislature to do that. Fill us in a little bit, Zach, on that effort and how realistic is it?
So as John was saying, in the legislature, the idea is that, you know, they're working within a fairly narrow framework of ideas in terms of addressing, you know, school safety, mostly conservative ideas, you know, this idea of arming teachers or non-controversial ideas like, you know, expanding mental health and hardening schools. But the proposals that a lot of, you know, people, a lot of Democrats especially, but others as well, really want to push forward gun control proposals, are not going to really get probably a hearing in the legislature this year. Although, you know, last year they did pass some modest gun control measures in terms of making it from 18 to 21 to be able to buy a rifle, and also instituting a wait period for those purchases. It was actually fairly substantial when you look at the Republican legislature. They hadn't really passed any gun control measures in decades. So
yeah, you know, they did do a little. As a candidate, Ron DeSantis last year was opposed to that because of the that level of gun control. But go on, I interrupted.
Yeah, and the NRA was really upset with it, and they came out and were blasting the Republican legislature and basically put them on warning that we're going to, you know, get involved in these elections, and it's poison in a primary because of that. But, you know, they did push a little bit forward, but it's unlikely that, you know, some of these, you know, more aggressive ideas like banning assault weapons are going to go through the GOP controlled legislature, especially after some of the pushback they got last year from the modest gun control measures that they did put forward. So some folks have gotten together and organized to try and put a constitutional amendment on the ballot in 2020 to ban you know, so-called assault weapons. And if you know, our listeners probably know that these ballot measures have been a successful way to go around the legislature in recent years, whether it was for medical marijuana or doing land conservation or other issues. You know, there's been some success with these citizen-led ballot initiatives. So this one seems to have some legs. They've raised, you know, more than $400,000. They've started collecting signatures. There's some a bunch of prominent Democratic lawmakers are involved in it, but also a lot of families from Parkland, a lot of families of the victims, you know, are pushing this. The person who's leading it is the aunt of one of the victims, and it seems like you know, they probably have a decent chance of getting this on the ballot if they can raise enough money. So, you know, this might be something that even if the legislature doesn't do it, that could voters could decide on it in 2020.
And just a couple of key numbers to watch along the way to get a petition on the ballot. You need what, 760 some thousand?
Yeah, it's signatures. Like 766 or something like that.
But before that, the first kind of milestone is to get a 1/10 of that, like 76 or 77,000 signatures to
right.
The court to review it. Do you have any idea whether they're close to that number yet?
You know, I'm supposed to talk to the person who's organizing it today, actually. I don't believe they've hit that threshold for a Supreme Court review, but it does. They do. Based on the money they've raised so far, I think they're probably going to, you know, get that Supreme Court review fairly quickly, and then it just becomes a measure.
And it just for you know, for people listening, just to watch. So that's kind of the first key milestone is getting the court to review it, then getting enough signatures to put on the ballot, and then if it's on the ballot in Florida, you need 60% approval for it to be added to the Constitution. So we'll definitely want to keep tabs on that. Let's move on. In Tallahassee, Ron DeSantis has proposed his budget. You know, last year, if you had looked into a crystal ball and said the governor in 2019 was going to propose record spending levels and that his budget plan would get applause from Democrats and kind of a lip curl from the Republican House Speaker, you might have thought that Democrat Andrew Gillum had won the governor's race, but that's not the case. It's actually Ron DeSantis, conservative Republican, who is proposing this, I believe it's $91.3 billion spending plan. John Kennedy, give us some of the key points in the first Ron DeSantis budget.
Yeah, Georgia, you know, for a guy that ran as a fiscal conservative and who, you know, as a Washington congressman railed against government spending, well, DeSantis's first budget is stunningly robust. But we do have a little bit of sound here from the governor talking about what he's trying to do with his budget.
This is a budget that is keeping in line with Florida being a low tax state, looking out for taxpayers, providing particularly middle income families tax relief. It's also fiscally responsible. We have $5.2 billion in reserves, including $1.6 billion in the budget stabilization fund. If you look, the $91.3 billion top line is an increase over the enacted budget of the current fiscal year, but you also have to look at, I mean, you're seeing big increases because of the disaster, and these are things that we have to obviously attend to. So I think all told, this is not a budget that is spending money unnecessarily.
Well, you can sort of hear in his comments maybe, you know, that he feels a little bit defensive about the size of that spending plan, $2 billion bigger than the current budget. And, as we mentioned, at $91.3 billion, it's the biggest in state history. He wants increases for the environment, for schools, a slightly larger workforce, and he sets aside what for Republicans might be considered a kind of modest amount of tax breaks, $335 million. And even that is kind of a egalitarian tax break. It's mostly for property owners in the form of a slight rollback of school property taxes. House and Senate Democratic members gave the DeSantis spending plan a once-over this week, and it was Democrats who spoke most favorably about it. I think we have some sound from Representative Evan Jenny, who reflected on the past two terms of Rick Scott budgets, and here's what he said.
Off by saying this is probably the best proposed budget in, let's say, 8 years. We'll go with 8 years.
And there's another South Florida Democrat, Representative Joe Geller. He also talked it up with some cautions.
We'll share the basic sentiment that Representative Jenny just expressed. While the devil's still always in the details, I did hear a lot that sounds very promising.
Meanwhile, you know, Republicans stayed kind of quiet. House Speaker Jose Oliva, who was an early endorser of DeSantis during the campaign, he kind of sniffed at what the governor put out and said that his chamber plans to do a budget that cuts per capita spending in Florida. I haven't done the math on that, but it probably means it'll be smaller than the current $89.3 billion budget. So all told, you know, DeSantis's early allies are Democrats. And Republicans, though, they don't seem quite ready to rough up the new governor on this. He seems to be extending his political honeymoon here into a second month.
And so this is the second week in a row, you know, Jose Oliva, a significant figure in that he was an early endorser of DeSantis when much of the party establishment was behind Adam Putnam for governor back in the Republican primary. But now, you know, last week we talked about Oliva kind of differing with the governor on smokable marijuana. And here he, is a little bit seems to have a politely expressing some reservations about this budget plan. So that's pretty interesting. What's your sense of where this will all end up, John Kennedy?
Well, it's always a give and take here toward the end of a legislative session. The House and Senate do their own versions of the budget, the governor kind of sets a blueprint here, and how much it'll be embraced is a question. But DeSantis, has laid out some top priorities involving environmental spending, redoing the best and brightest teacher bonus plan, which is something that the legislature has resisted redoing or changing much. I think DeSantis's priorities will probably get a fair bit of respect from this Republican legislature, especially if DeSantis's kind of bipartisan popularity, which we've noted in early polls have come out that suggest that he's more popular now than he was when he was elected in November. Those kind of things help sway the legislature.
There you go. Well, John Kennedy will be right on top of that in Tallahassee. Well, let's move to Sarasota now. James Comey, the lanky former FBI director, was in town, and Zach Anderson caught up with him. Zach, tell us about, first of all, what was the venue, or what type of event was this where James Comey appeared?
So it's a big speaker series that's put on by a local Ringling College Library Association. It's the biggest kind of speaker series of the year in this area. They get a lot of high profile figures in politics and media to come in, and it usually attracts a pretty big crowd. They do it at the Van Wezel Auditorium, which holds around 2,000 people, and people get their tickets early on, and usually it sells out. So he was part of that event.
And tell us about what did James Comey have to say?
Yeah, he's had a lot to say, actually. You know, he did a 20-minute press conference before the event, and then he did a 40-minute speech, and then he did a 20-minute Q&A afterwards. So it was a whole lot of Comey, and he touched on all of the controversial Comey stuff that we've heard a lot about over the last 3 years. There was tons of Clinton email questions. He said that there's 0% chance that she would be prosecuted based on the evidence, which is interesting. You know, he's really staunchly defending the decision not to move forward, with any charges against her, which probably still rankles a lot of conservatives. And then he also defended reopening the email case 11 days before the election and notifying Congress that he had gotten this new batch of emails that he was looking into, which Clinton specifically blamed that in her book, What Happened. She blamed that on her loss on that and pointed the finger at Comey. And, you know, he was asked about that multiple times and said, you know, I had a decision whether to hide this or to tell people about it. And I just felt like transparency was important. And he totally defended that decision and said that he has no regrets about it, even though it does make him, quote, you know, a little bit sick to his stomach that he might have influenced the election, that, you know, he didn't want to do that. But so he defended his actions on the Clinton emails. And then, of course, there was a lot about the president. Comey has been a fierce critic of Trump and a strong defender of the Mueller probe. Of course, it was Comey's firing by Trump that actually triggered the deputy attorney general to appoint a special counsel. So, you know, he was played a central role in that, and he has strongly defended that probe. On Sunday, Trump went on Face the Nation and again bashed the Mueller probe as a witch hunt. And I asked Comey about that.
I would just say it's a serious, important investigation being conducted by serious people. It's been highly productive. If you know the business, you know that Bob Mueller's folks have produced complex charges unraveling the Russian effort to steal information, their effort to influence our election, and done all that in about a year and a half, which is, in my view, at high speed and in a quality way. So it's an important piece of work. I don't know where it will end up, and I tell folks, I hope people don't root for a particular outcome. We should all root only that the work be finished and that the facts be found. Whatever they are, but they ought to be. It ought to be seen through, because it's the kind of thing that this country counts on, has long depended upon, and no matter what your political background, you should support this sort of work.
So there you have Comey disputing that this is a witch hunt. You know, on Face the Nation, Trump also sort of tried to minimize a lot of the charges that have come forward by either saying they had nothing to do with Russia collusion, or that they were, you know, sort of minor things like, you know, just lying to investigators. And I asked Comey about that. I asked him about it a number of times, but specifically in regards to Roger Stone, the Florida man who was the most recent person indicted by Mueller, and a bunch of the charges against Roger Stone were these charges of lying to investigators. And again, Trump and a lot of his supporters have sort of tried to minimize those types of charges. And this is what Comey had to say about that.
I have a wry smile when I hear people, especially Republicans, calling these process crimes. The same people who thought Bill Clinton should be impeached and removed from office for lying. It really matters that people be held accountable for lying during a criminal justice investigation, because all we have is the insistence that people tell the truth in an investigation. And if that ever slides away from us, we're lost. And so these aren't process crimes. These are very serious crimes that strike at the heart of our criminal justice system. You got to investigate them. You got to prosecute them.
A few other just takeaways that I had from his appearance. It was really interesting. Here in Sarasota, the city itself is kind of liberal. There's all Democratic city commissioners, but the surrounding region is pretty conservative. And so I was wondering if Comey might get heckled a little bit by the crowd. He's a very, very polarizing figure now. And I think he's been criticized by both the right and the left. But I think right now he's getting a lot more criticism from the right because he's such a staunch Trump critic. And so I was wondering, people who come to this speaker series, they get their tickets in advance. They buy tickets for the whole series. And it seems to typically be sort of a mixed crowd partisan wise. So I wondered if Comey might get heckled by, conservatives in the crowd because he is such a polarizing figure. But, if there were people who disagree with him, they held their tongue and he actually got a couple of standing ovations. So interesting to see the response from the crowd.
Yeah, interesting stuff there. I hear that music again. That's our pick a number music. Funky royalty free pick a number music. Let's go lowest to highest. My number, I'll go first, was 13.6. I'm going to do a John Kennedy this week. That's 13.6 million. That's the amount of dollars the Government Accountability Office says was spent by the federal government on President Donald Trump's first four trips to Mar-a-Lago back in the early part of 2017. The biggest chunk of that money, about $8.5 million, was for the Department of Defense for costs associated with Air Force One. Secret Service was about $1.6 million, and there's about $3.4 million spent on the Coast Guard. Mar-a-Lago, remember, faces both the ocean and the intercoastal waterway in Palm Beach, so you had a lot of Coast Guard craft there patrolling the waters when the president is in town. So, as I said, that was for four trips in 2017. Trump has made a total of 19 trips to Palm Beach as president, so... If you do the math, I think you can conservatively estimate that the federal government has spent well north of $60 million on Trump's Florida trips so far. Zach Anderson, you had also a decimal point number. You had 50.7. Tell us about that number.
George, you kind of set me up on this here. You mentioned that it takes 60% support to pass a constitutional amendment. And that's important because right now, this constitutional amendment to ban assault weapons, they've pulled quite a bit on this in Florida over the last year since Parkland to see how people react to banning assault weapons. And the most recent poll from Florida Atlantic University in September showed support for a ban at 50.7%, so well below the 60% threshold, and it's actually support is down from 69% of people supported banning assault weapons right after Parkland. So it just sort of shows how after a tragedy, people get really gung-ho about trying to do something, and maybe they're more amenable to some of these more aggressive actions, but support seems to have waned a little bit over the last year. Important to point out, though, that about 19% of people surveyed in September were undecided on a ban. So there's plenty of room to convince those folks and reach the 60% threshold. But there's also probably likely to be a campaign against it. The NRA and other groups, if it does get on the ballot, are likely to fight it. So no sure thing that the public would support something like this.
A lot of room for persuasion, as you mentioned, which means a lot of opportunity for consultants on both sides to make some money off the deal. Okay, well, our last number, John Kennedy had a 793. Please tell us about that number.
Yeah, George, 793 is the increase in the number of state employees that Governor DeSantis includes in his budget proposal. Florida has had the lowest ratio of state workers to population in the nation It's roughly half the national average. And the number of employees has declined each of the past 3 years, and it's been trending downward even longer than that. But DeSantis kind of flips the script. He funds 112,874 positions across state government in his $91.3 billion bold vision for a brighter future budget. Now, it's not as if DeSantis, though, has suddenly turned into, you know, Daddy Warbucks. He's looking at this, of the 793 additional FTEs, well, 573 are basically mandatory. They're going to go to mental health services within the state's prison system. That's all part of a legal settlement that ended a lawsuit alleging poor treatment. That was brought by the Disability Rights Florida organization, and that's going to be also part of it, the budget going into this coming year.
All right. So, yeah, who would have thought Ron DeSantis expanding government in Florida?
Big spender.
If his budget is approved. Well, that wraps up another one of our Inside Florida Politics podcasts. I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. It has been my honor to be your host. Thank you for listening. I've been assisted here in West Palm Beach by Corzano. That's the team of Thomas Cordy and Joe Corzano. I've also been joined by John Kennedy, the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief in Tallahassee, and by Sarasota Herald Tribune Politics Editor Zach Anderson. Thank you.